copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The title, I Attack You With Words, is just a quote. I'm not really going to attack you with words, at least I hope so. I came across Peter the Venerable while I did my PhD. I was looking for someone from the Middle Ages who tries to argue as comprehensively and generally for the truth of the Christian message, of the gospel, of the scriptures, the Christian worldview. And that's why I came across Peter the Venerable. I now want to introduce you a bit to him. And I have two somewhat shady reasons for... I thought of the question, why should anyone, occupy himself or herself with Peter the Venerable and the Middle Ages and the Latin apologetic that no one ever reads or read? And I have two shaky reasons. The first one is a man called Ethan Zuckermeyer. He says... He's a researcher and a blogger from Harvard, and he says, big, geeky, white American guys tend to interact with a lot of other geeky, white American guys on the internet. So this is his area of research. And this tendency, of course, is not confined at all to the internet or Americans. Okay, so this is also the same in Europe. But Christians are willing and able to leave their own environment. They are willing and able to reach out to people who are very different. So this is the first question. Are we reaching out to people who are very different from ourselves? And in Peter the Venerable, we see somebody who really tried to do that. And my next reason is that there is a lot to learn. Apologetics did not stop with Augustine, and it also did not start with C.S. Lewis. There was something going on in between, and I think that we can learn something from it. I at least did, and there's still a lot for me to learn. Now, who was Peter the Venerable? Here's a picture. So maybe that's what he looked like, and maybe not. He was a monk, an abbot, in the 12th century, early 12th century. He became the abbot of a monastery called Cluny, here, in 1122. And today, probably he's best known for protecting the philosopher and theologian Peter Abelard by granting him asylum in Cluny. And we also may maybe cherish his warm words of comfort to Eloise after Abelard's death. But this is a tragic love story which is far too sentimental for ELF. So you have to check it up when you are at home. As abbot of Cluny, he presided over a network of approximately 600 cloisters and monasteries all around Europe and 10,000 monks. So this makes him one of the eminent church politicians of his time. And he was also involved in lobbying for the crusading ideology. Let's take a very quick look at that. He was mostly in favor of the ideal goal of the Crusades, at least until 1151. When you see me sigh like this, I have to skip over a lot of material, so there's room for you to ask questions later. But anyway, a paper by Virginia Berry sums it up like that. She writes, "As we look back over his life, we find that his essential attitude to the crusade had not changed over the years. In its ideal meaning as an unselfish, sacrificial journey to faraway lands to combat the enemies which were threatening the shrines of the Christian faith, the crusade attracted his admiration and support. Towards the end of his life, Peter speaks very differently in his book, and we're going to get to that very shortly. He speaks about love and rationality and so on. Did he lie? I don't think so. Barry investigates the period before the book was written that we're going to talk about. This is why I do not doubt Peter's sincerity, because people may change, even Christians, even medieval Christians may change. So he was not only in favor of the Crusades, he was also criticizing the Crusades. And that started probably before the Second Crusade. And he decided to approach Islam and its adherents with arguments. So he writes, he starts his written reply to Islam, the part that was addressed to Muslims. He starts it with these words. I think they are quite moving. "I attack you indeed, but not as our people often do, with weapons, but with words, not with force, but with reason, not with hatred, but with love. With a love, however, which is such as ought to exist between admirers of Christ and those averted from Christ, just as it existed between the apostles and the heathen of those times, which were invited to the law of Christ. Just as it is exerted by the Creator and Governor of all things, God Himself, towards those whom He, while they were still serving creation, not the Creator, dissuaded by the help of His servants from adoring idols and demons." So he says, "I am attacking you, but now with words, not with weapons as our people usually do, not with hatred, but with love." And the result of this effort was the unfinished text against the sect of Saracens, or the Latin title is Contra Sectam Saracenorum, and this is, of course, Austrian Latin. Okay, so you have to translate it into your own country's Latin. Okay. Now, Peter and rational argumentation across worldview barriers. First, he had to deal with opposition. Before he could start doing it, he had to deal with opposition. He justifies his project against the severe accusations of different people. So such was the spirit of that time that you had to really give good reasons for doing apologetics instead of chopping off heads. And he does that in a prologue written not for his intended audience, the Muslims, but for Christians. And he apologizes for the length of the prologue, but he explains that it was necessary because of this severe opposition. The prologue tells us a lot about his motivation, hopes, and goals. So he tells us that he's following the church fathers' examples, and he cites them, he cites lots of them, going through various cases. And he says that they used written arguments and refuted heresies and errors in words and writing. And they threw their lances. and their lances were their arguments. No, they didn't have any other lances, the church fathers. They threw their arguments. He's using a lot of military metaphors, but they're always used in the context of to refer to words, arguments, and so forth. So, for example, Peter says that, well, the only real violence that he mentions is martyrdom. That's the only real physical violence that he mentions with respect to the church fathers. And martyrdom, of course, is not something you do to others. It's some violence that you suffer. And the sword that the church fathers used is the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God. And the part of the body that is involved is the tongue. So there's no doubt whether Peter still was thinking of violence, real physical violence. No, the church fathers did what he was going to, was what he was about to do as well. And because of their example, he's allowed to do it too. And the church fathers, of course, they were just following the example of the Apostle Paul, who also spoke about defeating opposing thoughts, not with material, but with spiritual weapons. And you can read about that in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 4 and 5. An additional motivation and a way of justifying his project was to invite his Muslim readers to salvation. So he imagines that a Latin book translated into a foreign language might possibly be fruitful to people whom the life-giving grace wants to win for God. He invites them to salvation. Another reason for doing what he did, another way of justifying his project, is that even if his book would not be translated into Arabic or would not help the Muslims, then he's still justified to do it, he thinks, because he hopes to furnish doubting Christians with arguments, and he hopes to prepare them for conversations and discussions with Muslims. And even if all of that does not happen, he says, you have to do your duty. You have to carry out your duty and trust God. So he says that the church fathers also didn't know whether their arguments would work or convince or somebody would ever profit from them, from their apologetic. But the church fathers knew that the Spirit blows wherever it pleases, and that neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything but only God who makes things grow. So the church fathers did plant and water as good servants, and this is also Peter's hope. He says, I will not err completely if I do with simple glance what is my duty. A labor taken up for the sake of God can certainly not remain fruitless. Whether it becomes useful for converts, withstands enemies, admonishes our people, or at least does not make the writer lack the promised peace for all people of goodwill. So even if all the other things will not happen, then he thinks that he's allowed to do it as long as this task will not take away this peace for all people of goodwill, which was promised at Christmas, at the first Christmas. So these are the reasons he puts forward for being allowed to do apologetic. Now, his worldview also allows him to do apologetics. He can draw upon a long-standing tradition of rational argumentation in Christianity, which started in the New Testament. And this is why Peter can cite so many examples. He knows his history. He also is convinced that religious beliefs are propositional. This means that they can be true or false. And this in turn means that you can talk about them and find out and you can evaluate them in discourse. So he explicitly says that mere claims or threats rather than rational arguments or authority or firm evidence cannot establish the truth of religious belief. We need more than just a claim or a threat, he says to his intended readers. Is it therefore just, is it rational that I, to whom not a single authority or rational argument has been shown, should believe you and agree to your law if all you do is pronounce anathema on me and threaten me with God's wrath? So to him, religious beliefs are propositional in nature. And he also is firmly convinced that inter-religious communication is possible. I mean, that you can talk with other peoples, even from other language groups and cultures, about religious propositions. If he hadn't thought that, he wouldn't have done what he did. And he was certain that he could learn to understand others, and that he could answer, and that they in turn could understand him. And of course he was certain that God would make fruit grow. So Peter is all for rational argumentation. And he demands that rational argumentation rather than violence. For example, he says, do not deviate alone from this universal habit of listening of all peoples and laws. After all, you are free to approve of whatever has been said or to disapprove, to assent or to dissent, after all the arguments have been discussed and put forward. So he's all for rational argumentation. And it's also a very important step in, or a very important component and element in rational argumentation. He also seems to respect his readers. So he's very frank with them. That's also a sign of respect. And he shows, it shows his honest intentions. He frankly and repeatedly invites them to salvation. So, for example, he says at one point, "My concern for your salvation made me write this, and my neighborly love, which I feel for you as for any heathen, but not as I feel it for Christians, because you are still very distant and unknown to me. So my neighborly love did not allow me to remain silent." He's very frank and honest with them. He's also polemical, and I could give you a couple of examples, but I will just limit myself to this argument that Peter puts forth. It's a well-known topos of anti-Islamic polemic, that the devil is the originator of the Quran. So he says, for example, he writes, for example, "He," that's Muhammad, "himself, or rather the devil who spoke through him, if you allow, knew that the Jewish and Christian law was of such validity," and so on and so on. So he says that it was not Muhammad who said that, it was actually the devil. And this is not going to be very helpful in dialogue. It's not going to help a lot. Actually, it's not meant as polemic. It's actually meant to excuse Muhammad for one thing that he says, which to Peter simply is diabolic. So he tries to excuse Muhammad for saying that by saying that the devil spoke through him. But it's not going to help in his project. So there's a lot which can be considered face-threatening and undoubtedly works against his intention of a real dialogue. And then there are also some problems of translation going on, but I'm not going to go into that. Let me just say something about this militant metaphors. So I think that dialogue involving different worldviews will inevitably lead to argumentation. You know, worldviews, they always come with a claim of universal validity. And when they come into contact, this will lead to argumentation, hopefully, and not just violence. So Peter the Venerable's militant metaphors, we might think they are probably due to the political and military reality of his time, but actually I think they are also very, very appropriate in some way. So this image of an attack with words, I think, is appropriate in an argumentative situation, but only if the attack is not directed at the people rather than their beliefs, and if it is conducted in a fair manner, and that's what Peter himself says. So I sometimes am a bit worried about Christians who use a lot of warlike metaphors. You know, they go on a crusade and they have enemies which they have to defeat. So I think for people who are not yet sympathetic to the Christian convictions, to the gospel, this might sound very repulsive. But if you do it like Peter the Venerable and explain what you mean by it, I think that's okay. But most Christians, when they use a metaphor like that, they don't explain it, and all that is left is the impression that they are very aggressive. So I think his metaphors are justified. And also he is very respectful towards the recipients of his book. So he has a very frank negative assessment of the Quran and of Muhammad, but he praises his readers time and time again. For example, he says, "You people, I say, rational not only by nature, but also reasonable by intellect and learning. If only you could open your ears at this point." So he praises them for their scientific and cultural achievements. And that's also part of why I think that he seems to respect his readers. And all of this is summed up by the sentence where where he says to them, these are the reasons why a Christian must love you and why he must wish you salvation. So there's no hidden agenda. He's very frank, and I think that he really respected them. How did he go about his project? What steps and what measures did he take to engage with his intended Muslim readers? Well, first, he realized you cannot do any apologetic in this situation. The conditions are simply not fulfilled. He notes that you cannot talk to them because we don't even know what they think. So let me read a longer quote, but it finishes with the words you see up on the screen. So he says, he discusses whether the erroneous teaching of Muhammad is called by the ugly name of heresy or taunted as pagan. It must be confronted in written form. Once the Jews marveled at the various languages of the apostles, that was at Pentecost. No, the apostles suddenly were able to speak so many languages. This old zeal has abated. It has gone away. No, there's no zeal, no enthusiastic effort to learn other languages. So this old zeal has abated. The Latins, the people who speak Latin, and even more our own contemporaries, only master the language in which they were born. And thus they could not perceive the nature of this grave error, not to say that they were unable to confront it. Therefore, my heart glowed hotly within me, and my senses caught fire. I was filled with indignation that the Latins did not know the reason for such a ruin, and that through this very ignorance, no one could be moved to resist, for there was no one who answered, because there was no one who understood. I think these are great words. There was no one who answered because there was no one who understood. So the conditions for apologetics were not fulfilled. Of course, there had been discourse and apologetics with Islam since the 8th century, but not in the Western European context. Especially in the West, there was too much fear and prejudice and ignorance. And there was no one who answered rationally because there was no one who understood. Next step, once you found out that, what do you do? You find out what they think and what they believe. And for Peter, this meant that he had to invest a lot of time and money and energy. He traveled to Spain, not just on that business, but also on that business. In 1142, he went to Spain, and he commissioned the first translation, the first Latin translation of the Quran and some other texts. And he tells us that the team of translators included a Muslim called Muhammad. So Peter, therefore, is credited with initiating Islamic studies in the West. How about that? You know, as a task for you when you go home, start a completely new field of scientific research. So he really tried to find out what they think and believe. Then he tried to get the brightest minds to do the job. He tried to persuade Bernard of Clairvaux to write a written refutation of Islam. However, Bernard of Clairvaux was heavily involved in propaganda for the Second Crusade. No, he was more for chopping of heads. He could not be persuaded and didn't do it. Therefore, Peter says, he took it upon himself with a heavy heart to write this refutation himself. So if you can't get the brightest mind to do the job, do it yourself. Do it yourself with a little help from your friends. Peter had a secretary, and he did a lot of preparatory work. And that was finished in 1155. And in the remaining year before his death, Peter could finish the first book that was planned and a first draft of the second book and the prologue for Christians. But he had further plans, of course. His plans didn't stop with writing the book. He really thought of reaching his audience, and his plan was to have the completed book translated for the first time into Arabic. He says, verily, it will be possible to translate what has been written into their language. just as on my instigation this godless heresy was made known to the Latins. Also among the other various languages of the earth, albeit unknown to us, mutual translation certainly will not be missing. So he's very hopeful that his book will be translated and will be helpful for them. By the way, this quotation is from the prologue. He's not telling the Muslims right away that what they think is a godless heresy. Okay, that's part of trying Christians to understand what he's planning and doing. Now, so these were his methods and plans and actions. I want to focus on a special topic. I compared all the arguments in Contra Sectam Saracenorum with four other apologetic books from different eras. That I did that for my dissertation, but I think that we should take another look at Peter Venable's text, because he tries to address a culture which is not his own. So he's different from the other apologetic texts which I used. And I just want to focus on one particular kind of argument, and that's argument from authority. So it's a very common thing, and all the authors that I investigated try to do it, to appeal to authorities which are respected by their addressees. Peter the Venerable also does that. So in the prologue, he uses the church fathers and similar people as authorities. In the rest of the book, he does not appeal to them anymore, or people like that, but he often appeals to his readers' convictions. And he says it even explicitly in something that I didn't put up on the screen. He says, "If I want to prove something, I therefore use examples of points which you have already conceded, which you have already acknowledged." So that's his strategy with authorities, to use authorities that are respected by his readers. And he appeals above all to his translation of the Quran and to Islamic tradition. For example, he says in this sentence, if Muhammad himself denied altogether being a prophet, would you go on calling him a prophet against his will? How so? So he uses the words of Muhammad to make his own point. But it's very interesting that I have to ask, where are the poets, philosophers, and scientists? This is something very common in all the other books that I investigated. They all appeal to poets, philosophers, and scientists. Well, you could say, of course, he has the Quran, and that's enough for him. He has got a lot of material there. But still, it's very uncharacteristic not to cite any poets, philosophers, and scientists. And it might make us suspicious whether he really knew the Muslims well enough. And then some of the authorities which he uses are just not impressive, and that really hardens this suspicion that he doesn't know them well enough. For example, he says at one point, according to divine law, as well as to as that law which surpasses the common and written law of all peoples, the Roman law, the burden of proof certainly always rests with the person who brings charges. So this burdensome discussion of who has the burden of proof has already started a long time ago. But my point is that he tries to convince them by referring to the Roman law, and that's not going to convince them at all. No, they have their own law. No, why should they care about what the Roman law says? So some of his authorities are not acceptable for Muslims. Another thing is that he does not make appeal often enough of everyday experience. It's very untypical of Peter not to appeal to what his readers could convince themselves of. No, he doesn't say anything like, just go and open the cupboard and then you will see the glasses in there, or something like that. No, he can't do it because he doesn't know that they have cupboards like that. He cannot make any appeal to what they could convince themselves of. And he also it sometimes appeals to everyday life, but it's not something that he can be sure that they also experience. For example, he once says, if it has been established that they have not been lost, those books, they certainly have not been corrupted either, for we frequently experience in everyday life how a secret known to only a few will not remain hidden for long due to human carelessness. So he says, okay, we experience it, but that's really one of the very few examples of him using any kind of argument like that. He also does not appeal to his own experience. He never says, I went there and I saw this or that, and not what they could convince themselves of. And that, those are both strategies very common in the other sources. And I think that the reason why he cannot do this is that he thinks himself to be too alien and strange to them, and vice versa. And he even makes this explicit in a couple of ways. For example, he says, vague news is coming from you in the East to us in the West. So he's sometimes insecure and foreign, and he doesn't know enough about them, but at least he knows that he doesn't know enough. That's very good. And his specific way of arguing from authorities shows this insecurity. He says, it might seem strange, and maybe it is, that I, a man who lives far away from you, speaking a different language, having a different confession, strange customs and habits of living, that I am writing to you who live in the eastern or southern parts of the world, and that I am attacking people with words, people whom I have never seen or perhaps will never see. So he knows that it's a bit strange and that they don't know each other well enough. But we could think of about the question whether that should actually keep you from doing anything. Well, it didn't keep Peter. He saw that it was his duty to do that. Now, the last thing that I want to talk about, it lessons for European apologetics. It's a bit grandiose, and it was suggested to me, this title. So I thought, well, what could I learn? What did I learn, actually, from this whole episode and from getting to know Peter the Venerable and his life and his book a bit? Is there anything to learn? The first thing that I think is, are we prepared to look in the mirror? Have we done a homework of this task of looking at ourselves first? You know, we could end up realizing, like Peter did, that the conditions for apologetics are just not fulfilled, that there is no one who answers because there's no one who understands. Peter the Venerable identified a lack of zeal, which leads to monolingualism, as the roots of this inability. So he says there's not enough enthusiasm and emotional eagerness to do something about these things, and because we don't have a lot of motivation, we don't learn other languages, or we don't get to know people who are very different from ourselves, and so we don't even realize how much we cannot confront or answer because we don't even understand. And I think this is true for all of us in some way. We have our closed circles, and we sometimes seem to have our favorite apologetic enemies. You know, if I asked you who's our number one apologetic enemy or target or whatever you would call it, you know, very militant metaphors here as well, you probably would say, well, the man who gets mentioned the most in a conference like that is Richard Dawkins. He's our number one apologetic target. And misunderstand me. I think it's very important that we read his books and think about his arguments and try to answer them. And we should pray a lot for him as well. Don't think that it's done as often as speaking about him among Christians, that they also pray for him. Don't misunderstand me, but maybe this is not all there is. Okay, so Richard Dawkins' book, well known. This is the Turkish translation. He sold many books. You know, he sold over 2 million books worldwide. But do you know this book? The Secret. It's a New Age self-help book which teaches you how you can become and have and be anything you want by the power of your thoughts. And this book did not sell only 2 million copies around the world. It sold 25 million copies. Okay, so are we spending 10 times as much reading and understanding and talking to people who like that book as we spend on Richard Dawkins? Just a question for you. I don't know. Have you done a lot of work on The Secret? I don't know whether you did it or not. Maybe you have other blind spots. So this is my first lesson. Is there maybe a blind spot somewhere? Are there very important topics out there which we do not understand and therefore do not have any answers for? Okay, that's the next thing is that there's a list of them. Are we prepared to take the effort? Well, when I look at what Peter the Venerable did, it's pretty amazing. You know, it took a lot of time and energy and money to do what he did. So can we pay this cost? Those translators, they didn't work for free. They had to be convinced, persuaded by large sums to translate the Quran. Are we willing to pay the cost as well? Are we even taking the effort to get to know the other person's point of view? Or are we simply satisfied with rumors and prejudice? No, we sometimes don't even check the facts. We just assume that we know them. And we sometimes attack a theory without understanding it. And that's an old problem in Christian apologetics, of course. Already Augustine had to say something on it. He said, now it is a disgraceful and dangerous thing for an infidel to hear a Christian, presumably giving the meaning of Holy Scripture, talking nonsense on these topics. And we should take all means to prevent such an embarrassing situation in which people show up vast ignorance in a Christian and laugh it to scorn. So it's an old problem that we as Christian apologists attack things that we don't know well enough and that we're satisfied with rumors and prejudices and we don't check the facts. Only if we know the other person, we can also identify some common ground to start the conversation from. And it might even be the case that we have to face opposition. You know, maybe it's not as severe as what Peter experienced that made him write almost an entire book just justifying that you're allowed to do apologetics. But it might be that people don't understand this and don't think it's very important and that you have to explain why it is important to your church or your pastor and that other people think you're a bit weird for thinking of arguments and all these things. Are we prepared to do that? Or are we prepared to enter into this fruitless search for partners? Like when Peter tried to convince Bernard of Clairvaux and he didn't succeed, so he had to do it by himself. So it might take a cost to do that. And I'm really in awe by Peter Venable that he was prepared to pay that cost. Yes. The question was whether I know anything about the effect of his work. No, he failed. But he was very hopeful. You know, he read the scriptures. He saw that the Spirit blows wherever he wants. He saw that the church fathers didn't know what will happen with their arguments and they still did it because it was their duty. So he was hopeful. He was prepared to love his audience. He didn't have any hidden agenda with them. He tried to respect them where he could find stuff that he could respect. And he told them. And he, when he wrote his book, he also tried to communicate effectively. That means that he did not write a sober treatise on religious philosophy. I love philosophy. I mean, I don't know why, but I'm in the philosopher's network. But that's not enough. It's not enough to go through arguments. He tried to also entertain his readers. You know, he inserted little stories and used various linguistic methods to make it readable and entertaining, some lively. And that's part of communicating effectively as well. So do we have the same hope that dialogue is possible and that we are entering into something very, very meaningful and important? I sometimes find this very difficult to maintain this hope, because I wonder where's the fruit of all this effort, and I would love to see more fruit. So when you have a meeting in your church and only 3 people show up, like I had on Thursday, I think, oh, was it really worth that? It's really weird. Why did that happen? So are you prepared to fail as well? Prepared to fail. Peter the Venerable did not reach his goal. On the Christian side, this whole crusading ideology only failed after military defeats. So his arguments for rational argumentation were not heard at all by the Christians. No, they only changed their minds after they lost the war. So he failed in that respect. And he did not know his intended readership's beliefs and everyday lives well enough. And that undermines his efforts, of course, to understand them and to talk to them, communicate to them understandably. He did not reach the Muslims. His book was not translated into Arabic. And then he died. He died before he could finish it. And you see this even in the book, that it's not finished. So he failed. Are you prepared to fail as well? Maybe that's your duty. To fail.
Maybe you will always.
Yeah.
Continue what he started. And succeed.
Yeah, yeah. I know at least one person who, as you say, who benefited from what he did. And that's me. You know, I sometimes speak on whether the Christian faith is good for society. And when you speak about a topic like that, everybody will say, have you forgotten about the Crusades? And then I can cite Peter's words and I say, well, you know, the Crusades, they were a horrible crime. And even at that time, there were Christians who criticized them. And Peter says, I attack you, but not as our people often do, with weapons, but with words, not with hatred, but with love. So that's very good for me that I'm able to cite this example. And I can show that the trouble with the Crusades was not too much Jesus, but too little Jesus. And that if the gospel sinks in, you realize that we are called to love our neighbors and not chop their heads off. Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Roderich. I have to repeat this question now. And the question is, isn't there also a more positive way? And by the way, now we have finished with what I prepare. And in order not to postpone the matter, let us no longer throw the bullets from afar, but let this struggle turn into close combat. So throw your questions and comments at me. But let it be peaceful, not angry. Reasonable, not mad. Just, not unjust. You know, we love the truth. And so Roderich's comment was, shouldn't we also make the case for a different case concerning this question of the Crusades? Because the Crusades, they can also be understood in a very different way. For example, when you read that book by Rodney Stark, God's Battalions, and another book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Crusades or something like that. Okay, I don't know that one. And we can, of course, if you are speaking to historians about the topic of violence in religions or something like that, you can, of course, make a historical case and you can say, look, the Crusades were a reaction to military aggression. And if you hear that the most sacred shrines of your faith are being flattened and that no Christian will be allowed to go to Jerusalem to worship there anymore, then you might also react being attacked in a way. And of course the Crusades started when the emperor of Byzantium, how do you call it in English? Byzantium?
Byzantine.
Byzantium. When he called for help, that's when the Crusades started. Yes? So you should really be careful of when you want to make that point. When I speak to an audience of people who have this prejudice in their head that there is no... it's just because Christians are evil that the Crusades started. Then I don't try to convince them that this is wrong. I just want to tell them, I want to point them to Jesus. And I want to tell them the trouble with the Crusades was not too much Jesus, but too little Jesus. Not enough Jesus. So that's a point that I would like to make. I don't want to get into... I would not go into this whole question, because actually, when we think about it, you know, if... a sacred site in Jerusalem gets attacked by Muslims, where in the gospel exactly does it tell me to take up my sword and kill that person? I read different things in the gospel. So there's a whole new discussion starting now. I can see it, but it's going to start very soon. So the point that I want to make is that even at that time, and I don't want to, you know, when you are proud of wading through the blood of your enemies that you killed for the glory of God, no, I don't think that we should gloss over that and say that it was a good thing. No, it was a horrible crime. You know, killing people who wanted to surrender and all that stuff, they are crimes. So I'm honest. But I think the trouble was not enough Jesus, because Jesus preaches love, and Peter the Venerable understood that. Yes, please. The question is, the way that he operated, was it something that simply happened because it came out of who he was, or did he put down a plan of what to do? So I'm not quite sure how to answer this question. He was the abbot of Cluny. He was a very capable administrator and leader. So I'm sure that he had plans which he went through. And this can also be seen by going to Spain, not only on some kind of business, but also in order to get the job of translating the Quran done in 1142. So that was a long, many years of going on while this project lasted. And then he had his secretary do preliminary work, and then he sat himself down to write. And he changed. He did not always follow what his secretary wanted him to write about. So I think we have a sort of contents list by his secretary, and we see that Peter the Venerable changed that. So I think it was very deliberate, the whole thing, but I can't really tell you whether he had a sort of a master plan. What he did realize was that no one answered because no one understood. Therefore, we must first get to understand it, get it translated, try to get a really good guy to write something about it, get it translated back into Arabic, and see what God does. So that, I think this was a plan, but I can't tell you. It's more speculative. But he was a capable administrator and reformer in Cluny. The question was whether he was received by Muslim theologians, and he wasn't at all. He died before he finished the project, and his book was never translated into Arabic. So this is the way he failed. One of the ways he failed. So there was no, there were not letters being sent to and fro. So it didn't work out in that way. Well, of course, having translated the Quran, this became very influential in Western Europe, because that was the version of the Quran which was there for a long time. Yeah. There's even an edition with a preface by Martin Luther. Mm-hmm. So the comment and the question was... what do I think about other ways of presenting the gospel to people apart from rational argumentation? And you quoted or you cited an example of somebody who's walking around the streets offering to pray for people in Muslim countries, and when they get healed, they are very impressed by the word of knowledge. And then the other question was, what are the top two or three areas of apologetics? So I'm all for what you said. It's completely true, and we should never limit the presentation of the gospel to simply putting out rational arguments. You know, when Peter says in 1 Peter 3, he says, always be prepared to give an answer to people who ask of you a reasonable account of the hope that is within you. But this presumes that people are asking questions about this hope that is within you. And how can they ask questions if they don't see any hope? And how can they see any hope if they don't have any kind of relationship to you? So, yes, this is it's a very important element to also give rational argumentation, but it's not the only thing. And Origen said Jesus has his defense, his apologia, in the life of his followers. So this is the most effective apologetic, I think. And there are many different ways of engaging with people. So, and it's fantastic to hear about that. I mean, I just recently read a book about dreams and visions that people in Muslim countries have of Jesus. They dream of a man in a white robe, and they know that Jesus is visiting them without this man telling them. They just know it's Jesus. And it's fantastic. People get to know Christians later, and they then can understand what this experience means to them. So the Lord is reaching out to people in many different ways. But still, always be prepared to give an answer to people who are asking a reason of you. So this is not unimportant. This is not only for specialists. It doesn't say if you are very intellectually minded, be prepared. Peter says that to any Christian. Be prepared. But it might look differently when somebody who studies philosophy at Oxford does it than from when somebody who is a peasant in a village in Austria does it. So, but still, both Christians have to be able to give some kind of reason for the hope they have. So maybe that was a question. So top areas of fruitful engagement. Well, we were talking about this in the car when we came, and in one way, the main things about human lives, they don't change. People want to know why they are there for and what will happen to them after death. And we, all of us, experience guilt and disease and death. So we have questions about dealing with guilt and suffering. So these are always, I think, timely topics. But then there's something happening, of course, that our very cozy lifestyle now it hasn't really been threatened. But we hear on the news constantly about crisis, this crisis, that crisis. You know, states have too much debt. The environment is going down. There's even a war going on in Europe, which you would never have imagined half a year ago or so. So I think this living with a constant crisis is a topic that we should think about more. What does it do to people, and how can we how can we help as Christians in a way? So these are two things that I would say, maybe. But maybe you have other ideas. I mean, I once wanted to start a project where I look at European top sellers, because I think they are telling us something about what people are thinking about, what is important to them right now. So when you see a book like that, number one in the top selling lists for half a year, and then spawning a whole industry of books that that look a little bit like that in the bookshops, you know something is going on and people really are thinking about that. It was the same with the book called The Shack. No, it was very sad because in Austria this was number one. And I don't know of many churches who ever did anything about it. It was a book that was talking about the Trinity and that you can find forgiveness in Jesus. And we don't have to go into any problems. I mean, just these two topics would make great conversation starters with people. And we should start to be aware of what's happening. But I'm not very good at that myself. I did, however, write an article about the secret. That's why I dared to take this as an example. Any other questions? So the question is whether I know anything about how, from Peter writing it, this came to us. So it somehow did come to me. That means that it was not lost, and maybe it was read by Christians. It was not only the Quran which was translated, there was also a whole corpus of writings that got translated, and they have been, of course, handed on in Europe. I have tried to find an English translation of Contra Sectam Saracenorum, but I couldn't. Do you know any English? Please tell me about it. I'm trying to write a paper on it, and I have to do all the translation stuff myself, and it makes my head explode, and the editor wants to make me changes. So it would be so great to have an English translation. There's a German translation. You had a question also. So the question is, I referenced hope a lot when I, for example, quote 1 Peter 3, 15, he says that we should be prepared to give a reason for the hope that we have. And I mentioned this a couple of times. What do I mean by that? Well, if you read 1 Peter, you will see that we have a living hope, and God has given us new birth and has completely changed us. And this is our new identity. And that's the first part of 1 Peter. And then it starts in 2 chapter 11, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God and on the day he visits us." So the theory of the Bible, which is a good theory, is that from our new identity in Christ and our living hope, there grows a new kind of life, a new way of life, which is visibly doing good things. And this is and people, when they don't have hope for the future, when they despair of suffering, of death, and I mean, the culture that these words were written to was, somebody characterized it as a culture full of despair. You know, there was no hope, and you couldn't even turn to the gods because they were so capricious. They did whatever they want. You know, one day they help you, the next day they kill you. And there was no hope, and after death you're just dead. So, and now Christians, they live a different way of life. They do good stuff to others, even if they don't have a payoff for themselves, because they have hope in eternal glory. They have hope in an inheritance which will never rot in heaven. That's in chapter 1. So it shows somehow our lives are different. And then when this shows up and we live, we function as the church in that way in our environment, and people will start asking questions, and they will ask us. So I think that's the way that 1 Peter works. Yeah, you should all read it and learn it by heart. Okay, time's up. Thank you for coming. It was great.